Good morning. We thank you for tuning into our radio program today. This program is brought to you each Sunday morning by the Parkway Church of Christ here in Bowling Green. We appreciate those who listen over the radio broadcast, and of course, we know several of you use the internet, use the website, and stream the files from there. But either way, we're happy that you have an interest in the things that we're talking about. And we appreciate many of you who are regular listeners all across the country. We also want to remind those locally here, as we typically do, of the importance of worship together. And there may be, of course, many in this listening audience that have plans for worship services every week and multiple times a week. And that's very commendable. But it could be that there are some in the audience who maybe you've left a church. I hear of this happening just a lot anymore. Maybe you've left a church and you're looking for a church that will stand upon principles of truth. We believe we have that to offer to you. We also have something else. If you were to meet with us or visit with us and conclude that we have taught something inaccurately or that we have failed to bring the whole counsel of God on some subject, or we have practiced something that is not authorized in the Scriptures, we will be more than happy to listen to you and to consider what you have to say about that. Now, it could end up being that what we have done is what the Bible teaches, but we will have the responsibility to prove that to you. It could be that we are wrong and need to repent of our error. So nothing but good, as they always say, and rightly said, rightly observed over the years, nothing but good can come from just simple, straightforward, old-fashioned Bible study, a consideration of what God's Word has to say. So we appreciate this, and we appreciate the fact that we have an understandable gospel. That's what Paul called it in Ephesians chapter 3. He said, when you read, you'll be able to understand or know my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which means that we will all be able to have a like understanding, not just our own peculiar differing understandings, but a common understanding. It's just a matter of being open and honest as we investigate the Scriptures. But we do appreciate you tuning in today. I was thinking recently that given just how radical things have become in the realm of sexuality, with all of the transgender issues, homosexuality, and so many things, a drag queen story hour we talk about from time to time on the program, all of these types of radical things, would it be possible that people could forget what the simple plan is, God's simple plan for sexual relationships? Would it be possible? And then the other thing would be, would it be possible for us to be desensitized by things that we used to, rules, laws governing marriage, things that we used to almost take for granted, we just assumed and understood to be true? Would it be possible for us to be so desensitized by the radical, perverse sexuality and the perversity movement in that realm that we begin to forget what God's simple plan is? I think the answer is yes. This happens all of the time. And people do this by saying things like this. They'll say, well, I may have failed to fulfill my marital obligations. A person might say something like this. I may have failed to fulfill my marital obligations, but I'm not gay, or I'm not having some surgeries done to my body to try to change me from a man into a woman. I think that's how people do this. And they begin to reason backwards like that, and they begin to think that they're okay, even though they have also violated the standard of God's law and of human nature. So I want us to go back today and consider what the Bible has to say, what God has to say about marriage and about what is an approved sexual relationship. Jesus was extremely clear on this in Matthew chapter 19. The Pharisees had asked him a question in Matthew 19 in verse 3 about divorce, and that we're not going to be talking much about that today. We're going to be talking about marriage by God's design. But that was how this came up. And often, of course, it's almost unavoidable. You're going to get into a discussion about divorce because when you talk about marriage, because the divorce rate is so high. But let's see how this all came to be. What prompted Jesus to teach what he did on the permanency of the marriage bond, the covenant of marriage? In Matthew 19:3, it says the Pharisees also came to him as he was teaching, tempting him, saying unto him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause, or for just any cause, or for just any reason? Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" Now, verse 9 is going to answer that. But I want you to look at verse 4. Verse 4 says, "He answered and said to them, Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?" The first thing you read about this, when it comes to marriage and the binding nature of the marriage bond, the covenant aspect of it, the first thing you read is that he made them male and female. Male and female. And I always think it's interesting how that design has not changed. That, as we often say, men are still men, women are still women. Now, men may have surgeries and use cosmetics and clothing to try to appear to look like a woman. They may, as one person always says, put on woman face and try to look like a woman. But that doesn't make them a woman. It doesn't make them a female. That's a national debate right now, sadly. We talked about last week on the radio program. But what did God say simply about this? Well, he made them male and female. And said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." Now, I want to point out something, two or three things here about this verse. Number one, notice that there's going to be some type of open proclamation about what this couple is doing, what this male and female are doing. They're going to leave father and mother. In other words, they've decided they're no longer going to be a part of that household or those households. They're going to make their own. But he said they're going to cleave. He will cleave to his wife. Now, this is a term that has to do with bonding. It has to do with the permanency of this relationship, the idea of being glued or joined together. "And they two shall be one flesh." Now, all of a sudden, he's using a term that talks about the sexual relationship, one flesh. We know this from what Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul, now we will, you know, 1 Corinthians 7 does talk about marriage, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul is refuting some of the concepts of paganism and how the Corinthian brethren, of course, were still enticed by these types of things, still tempted by them. They grew up in that culture. And so Paul is having to write them here about fornication. Evidently, from what we read in verses 13 and following, there were some at Corinth that were making the argument that since sexual attraction is a natural thing, we have that by nature, that it would be no different than the desire for sex would be no different than the desire for food when you have another natural desire, which is hunger. So they had conflated those two things, and said, you know, when you get hungry, you eat. Well, when you have a sexual desire, you should have sex. Some were apparently making some argument like that. And then Paul has to refute this by pointing out that that is sexual immorality, that sexual relations belong in marriage. Now, he will teach that in the beginning of the 7th chapter, if you're interested in that. We might have time to get into that, probably will have time to get into that a little bit later here in the program today. But that's verse 7. Paul said, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. That's how that's done. Marriage. Which is exactly what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 19. But my main point, reason for going over here, is to notice Paul's statement in verse 16 of 1 Corinthians 6. Now remember what we read, Matthew 19. Jesus says that the two, the male and the female, will leave father and mother, cleave to each other, and then become, that is, they are authorized to be or become one flesh. What is one flesh? Some people read that and just think it's just a marriage contract, but it's a little bigger than that, something different than that, something that's included in as a right, something that is now authorized as a result of the marriage bond. 1 Corinthians 16 says, what, know you not that he which is joined to a harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. What is Paul doing here? If a man, there were male prostitutes, so it could have been women with men prostitutes, but let's assume here that he's talking about a female harlot and not a whoremonger. So he says harlot. And so if a man has sexual relations with a woman, not his wife, maybe a prostitute or anyone, what is that called? Well, he said one flesh. Now, does that mean that you're bound by God in marriage, the man who has sexual relations with a prostitute? Is that an act of a wedding ceremony? No, it is not. But what this does for us is show us that the one flesh expression refers to the sexual relationship in marriage. And this is very instructive because notice the order of this. You have the departure from father and mother, the open declaration of intent, right? That's what that is. Then you have vows, a cleaving, a joining, promises that are made to belong exclusively to one another in this one, now one flesh relationship. That is, the sexual relations are authorized as a result of the other factors that Jesus has mentioned here in verse 5. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So when you combine all of these things, what do you have? You have a marriage. And what have we just combined? Well, a man and a woman, not a man and a man. Not a male and a male, not a female and a female. Not in a God-approved marriage. Well, now I'm going to explain that later. There is such a thing as an unlawful marriage. We'll see that before we even get out of this text here in Matthew 19. But you have the declaration of intent on the part of the man and the woman, this vow exchanging, which is involved in the cleaving, and then the one flesh, that is the sexual rights to one another, the sexual part of the relationship. And God joins those people in the marriage bond. And the verse says, what God has joined together, that is, by His laws, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, let not man separate. God has done something here. What did God do? Well, God gave a law. And that's what's taught over in Romans chapter 7. God gave a law of marriage. In Romans 7, in verse 1, Paul said, Know ye not, brethren, for I speak to them that know the law, how that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. Okay, now what, some of you familiar with your Bibles know what Paul's about to do here. What illustration or relationship he's going to use as an illustration. What illustration he's going to use, I was about to say there. For the woman which hath an husband is bound how? By the law. By what law? By the law of God. Bound by the law of God to her husband for as long as he lives. But if the husband is dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. What if a woman marries a man and the man later dies? Well, she's no longer bound to him. They're no longer husband and wife. She is freed, we're about to read. So then, if while her husband lives, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man. So here is how the law of God works. The law of God stipulates certain things and binds people to their oaths, and thus in that covenant that they have entered. So if you're talking about marriage, we could be talking about other vows, but if you're talking about marriage vows, as Paul does in Romans 7, 2 and 3, then you're talking about a binding commitment where the marriage partners are not free to engage in sexual relations with other people. They are now obligated to one another, and thus the old phrase, one man, one woman for life. That's what you conclude from these verses, and particularly from, especially from Romans chapter 7 in verses 2 and 3. One man, one woman for life. If you combine Matthew 19, 4 through 6 with, of course, with Romans 7, it is just airtight. The conclusion is just unavoidable. But I believe it's possible that society can become so desensitized and indoctrinated by the changes that are so rapidly occurring in what people accept as normal and right in regard to sexuality, that these old principles might be forgotten. How many young people are being taught this anymore? That marriage is for life and that it's between a man and a woman? How many are? Well, I want to show you something about the word marriage here, so this makes us have to be a little careful. There was, of course, some resistance on the part of the Pharisees. Verse 7 of Matthew 19 says, they say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. In other words, it has never been so. It was not so from the beginning, and it is not so now. What they did was invoke the old Deuteronomy 24 clause. And that was a legislation that was added. It was given because men had become so abusive of women, treating them like property, treating them like trading cards. They would just divorce freely for just any cause. They would just divorce and marry others, and then if they decided that they didn't like the new one that they'd married, they'd divorce her and marry another. So then you had Deuteronomy 24. And what Jesus is trying to say here, not trying, but is saying, what Jesus is saying here, I should say trying to convince the Pharisees of, is that the original law was Genesis 2:24. When Adam said that the woman is now flesh and my flesh and bone of my bones. And he said in verse 24 of Genesis 2, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. By the way, how could he have been talking about the present time with just himself and Eve? They didn't have father and mother. So that fact that he says here, leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, proves that that had an extended application beyond the Garden of Eden and into all of human times. We know that because Jesus said that it was still the law. In Matthew chapter 19, he said, this is still the law. This is the way it was, and this is the way it is, verse 8. So, he disregards the Deuteronomy 24 quibble that they were making. And he says, no, let's go to the law of marriage. Let's not go to an exception contingency legislation that was given based upon the mistreatment of women by men, which was an addition to the original law. He said, let's go back to the original law. And that's what he did. But notice in verse 9, and this can be a little bit complicated. I want to try to explain it. He said, and I say unto you, whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife except for fornication, and that's sexual immorality of any kind, and shall marry another commits adultery, and whoever marries her which is put away commits adultery. Notice that Jesus talked about them unlawfully putting away, rejecting, repudiating, divorcing a bound mate, but it's, and then marrying another. What does he mean when he said marries another? Well, I want to show you something about this. There's been a controversy for a long time about this, and it seems rather simple to answer. Over in Mark chapter 6 and verse 16, John goes back to explain why John was imprisoned and ultimately beheaded. It says, but when Herod heard thereof, regarding John, he said, it is John whom I beheaded. And this is talking about the identity of Christ, but some had thought that John had risen from the dead. He said, it is John whom I beheaded. He is risen from the dead, for Herod himself had sent forth, laid hold upon John, and bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. Now, friends, watch this. For he had married her. He had married her. For John had said unto Herod, it is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife. All right, Herod had married his brother Philip's wife. Notice that the Bible here states in this that she is still Philip's wife. She is still Philip's bound mate, right? But what had Herod done? He had married her. Well, then you might say, well, then the marriage must be okay. No, John says it was not lawful for him to have his brother Philip's wife. She is still Philip's wife, but he had married her. What do you learn from the use, the Bible use, biblical use of the word married from Matthew 19:9 and other passages at like Mark chapter 6 and verse 18, 17 and 18? We learn that the word married is simply talking about a physical togetherness, a physical relationship. That's all it's talking about. It's not talking about the legitimacy of the relationship. The relationship may actually be illegitimate or, as John said, unlawful, or as Jesus said, adulterous. They might be married but living in adultery. Two men might marry each other, but they are living in sexual immorality. They may marry each other, but only in the sense of that the Bible uses the word of a physical relationship with each other, between two people. So we need to be careful about this. And the way to be careful is to use Bible language. If we use Bible language, we need to speak of marriages that are either lawful or unlawful. John said that Herod's marriage was unlawful. The lawful marriage was between Herodias and Philip, not between Herodias and Herod. You see what I'm saying? The lawful marriage was that one, but that marriage got broken up, you see. Philip's marriage was broken with Herodias, and Herod married Herodias. So now you have an unlawful marriage. Or as I said, Matthew 19, verse 9, you have an adulterous marriage. Let's look. We can learn a little more about this from 1 Corinthians 7. Paul, as I said, in 1 Corinthians 7, in the first few verses there, is answering some of the arguments that were being made by some liberals who were still steeped in paganism and were trying to justify just open sex with anyone in any way. And Paul says, no, that's called fornication. And in verse 18 of chapter 6, he had said, flee fornication. Flee fornication. He had said back in chapter 6 and verse 9 that fornication is one of the sins that will keep you out of heaven. So the argument that he addresses is sandwiched between explicit prohibitions against fornication or sex outside of marriage. So that should be clear. But the question might be raised, okay, well, what, you know, how do we avoid fornication? Well, if you want to avoid fornication, you need to marry. Every man needs to have his own wife, and every woman needs to have her own husband. Notice that he said here, he uses the Bible terms for male and female. Male and female. Then he uses terms that translators use when there is a possessive case involved. For example, what if a man wants a wife? Well, if he takes a woman as his wife, she is his wife because it's the possessive case of woman. And the same is true of the word husband, which is really just the word man, but in the possessive case, by the woman. So he is her man and she is his woman. That's Bible language, friends, right there in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2. May not sound politically correct, but it's Bible language. And we need to get back to that and not allow ourselves to drift away, to be tempted into or enticed into some new model of sexuality, new mode of sexuality. The Bible is very clear about this. Just as Jesus talked about a man and a woman, so does Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2. The Bible is very consistent on this. And then he talks about the responsibilities between the husband and wife. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but of the wife. What is Paul talking about here? Well, let's see. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency or lack of self-control, but it's a lack of sexual control in this context. So what do verses 3 through 5 teach? Well, clearly, they teach that as a result of marriage, the marriage bond, the husband has sexual responsibilities to his wife, and the wife has sexual responsibilities to her husband. That's what this passage is teaching. But some people say, yeah, but Paul said that it's okay to break that up if you want to. And here's where we need to be very careful. We don't have time to get into this today, I see from the clock, but Lord willing, next Sunday, I want to finish this and look at some things that do relate to the destruction of the marriage bond, or at least to the marriage, physical marriage relationship. And the bond, of course, is in the hands of God and controlled by legislation. But I want to explain that and talk about that then, since we're out of time. Hope you'll tune in then next week. Until then, we bid you a pleasant good day.